Welcome to Culture, Talent, and Growth. Join Anish Shah and the Ruckus team as they invite dynamic leaders to share what they've learned about creating lasting culture, attracting great talent, and achieving sustainable growth. Let's get started.
All right, everyone, thank you for joining. This is How to Build a World-Class Brand with Feather, Everbody, Better Mortgage, and Bumble. And now with a couple intros, Anish.
Yeah, hi. My background was previously helping to run growth for different companies, both full-time and as a consultant, for about 11 years. And then about 4 to 5 years ago, began running an executive recruiting firm focused on hiring growth, marketing, product, and analytics leaders. Now we're a team of, I believe, 14 people. And yeah, next is Kate.
Hi, guys. I'm Kate Twist. I am the co-founder and board chair of Everbody, which is a modern version of a dermatologist's office. I've spent my career in and around consumer products, previously in fashion and beauty, and began my career in investment banking for consumer products.
Cool. Derek?
Hey, guys. My name is Derek, originally from New Zealand, based in the US for the last sort of 10 years or so. Had over a decade at Google in various capacities, running Asia Pacific marketing, the family brand, and then my last 3 years running creator marketing globally for YouTube. After that, my career has really been in, I really found a love for subscription businesses, ran the international business for Tinder, a couple of years with Fair, an automotive subscription service, and then I was in a contract role helping Blackstone with their acquisition of Bumble, well-timed for their IPO leading up to Valentine's Day. And so pretty good pattern recognition across the subscription services space, and looking forward to the conversation.
Hi, I'm Janelle Shah. I lead marketing at Feather. We are like the run the runway for furniture. I think that's the easiest way for me to describe what we do. We're really about building a new behavior around and questioning the idea of ownership when it comes to furniture. Prior to Feather, I was at Swell, the very famous water bottle company. I still carry my Swell. And then Newell Brands. I also spent a decade on the advertising agency side, and really sort of the notion of brands driving culture and reflecting cultures at the heart of everything that I do and the lens through which I look at things. Very excited to have this conversation. This is my first chance really at building a brand from the ground up, and the playbook that I had over the years, not all of it was applicable. So I'm curious to learn from others as well.
I love that. I love that you call out the distinction as well, that you can't just basically roll out a playbook from a brand that's been around for 100 years and where that everyone already knows versus something that no one's ever heard of before. So that's really great. Jump into the next one. Patricia.
Patricia Court McDonald. I'm currently CMO of a company that is building a net new brand and platform focused on small business owners that goes to market next quarter. Prior to that, spent a year at Better Mortgage, which we rebranded to Better.com, building out their direct-to-consumer kind of platforms. And prior to that, spent the better part of a decade and a half at an agency called Huge that focused on digital transformation. So there's a lot of net new brand building there, but a lot of consulting with legacy companies that were bridging into the more digital future as well.
Wasn't it some insane number of people that reported to you or in some fashion at Huge?
Indirectly. There were about 1,200 in 10 offices worldwide. Yeah. I don't miss that. I'm hoping to leave before we hit that level of scale at each new company I go to. Just duck right out.
I remember asking Patricia for help on how to manage people because I was having trouble managing 12 people. 1,200 is just, I can't even wrap my head around it. So how do you test and do a target audience? And I'd be pretty curious to understand that also from like a brand that's scaled versus a brand that maybe you don't even know what your target audience is specifically yet, and probably even trying to figure out how to discover what is your target audience. So I'd love like any kind of stories or anecdotes or thoughts on how to kind of go through that process. If anyone has any thoughts, I probably won't be just like pointing at people and choosing them.
I think it's off and enough to get others started. You're so right. Like when we launched, our business is 5 years old and we're still learning new things about what appeals about our business to customers and what doesn't and what we think would work, what is working instead. The one really interesting thing that started to happen with our business is we realized that It wasn't designed for a very specific use case, but that's a use case we started seeing a huge amount of our customers beginning to come to us and use us for. They were sort of, we were working as a hacky solution for them, but we quickly realized that, wait a minute, we didn't design our business to satisfy this, but are we onto something here? That was a hypothesis based on some data that we were seeing. So we actually took that and we decided to run a controlled test. Luckily for us, we had a hyper-local market. So we are only operational in about 4 markets right now. So we can take something like that and run a very local test and see sort of, is it just a fluke? Is this a coincidence? Is this a seasonal thing? Or are there legs here for us to actually build out over time a true offering for this audience that we don't have right now? So that's at least how we've been approaching testing this target audience. We'll see. The test is live right now. If we are fully prepared right now to go back to the drawing board to re-examine both our assumptions, but also approach to the test depending on the learnings.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, I think, like what Janelle references, where city by city or audience by audience, there's a heavy lift to, the business model is a heavy lift to sort of to launch into that market, right? If I give an analogy of like pure direct-to-consumer software businesses, when you say test, I think I make a distinction between a product test and a messaging or a content or a brand test. I think great sort of software products, you want to enable yourself to launch everywhere at one go as much as possible. You need to understand localization. That's more than translation. But if you can get your product in to as many places as possible, as quickly as possible, without an opportunity cost on budget or time, what you can then understand from a product perspective is, where is there a natural product market fit, right? That's on the product side. So I'll give you an example of sort of like Tinder was fascinating. When I joined the Tinder business and there was no one focused outside the US, but Tinder was available in 39 app stores, actually 42. And so because you just needed to do, they had done really basic localization and it was really poor and there was a lot of upside, but it was available all around the world. Then what I could see was where's their natural product usage? Where's the usage that's above the developed market average of like the US or the UK? Where does it under index across a whole bunch of different metrics? So on a product perspective, if you can set it up so that you can be testing and learning from a product perspective as in many places as possible, that's different to a brand or a content or an audience or a value prop test, where what you're attempting to do is accelerate usage above a baseline, right? And I think, so message testing for sure. I think the one thing that's really important is I've seen some people on my teams in situations where people are afraid to test. They want data to prove every direction and every decision, and you're never going to have perfect information. Everything is a calculated risk. And so I think the only other piece I'd say is it's really important for people to have a strong hypothesis. That shows you've thought about what you're trying to test, you're anticipating a couple of outcomes, and you have an opinion going in, as opposed to let's just put some messaging out and see what sticks, right? That's not a helpful test, I think. But I think it's good just to understand the distinction between a product test, assuming there's little to no opportunity cost, compared to a message test or a brand test.
That's super interesting. I think your approach is a little bit more hyper in terms of testing as many locations as possible, as rapidly as possible. Sounds like kind of like your classic kind of multivariate. And what's the kind of thought process in doing that versus kind of going one location at a time? Is it just to gather as much data as possible and be able to make a little bit faster of a decision? And then does that come with any drawbacks, like just generally messiness or doing too much at one time or anything like that?
I mean, I also think it's based on stage of business, right? That's not what happened. Sean Rad and the founders of Tinder rolled it out, right? This was a business that was 3 years old from a launch perspective. And so that understood pretty good product market fit. And they were at that point in time where, okay, the investment here is let's get localized into as many markets as possible. I remember at Google, Eric Schmidt at one point in time said, I'm sick of this scaled, cascading rollout of a feature around the world. because we end up just giving more features to people in the developed world, and people in non-English speaking languages takes a long time for them to see value, and it's a long time for us to learn. And we're not offering our products to the greatest percentage of the population, right? And so he said he mandated that it was 48 markets and 52 languages from day one at Google. But that was a 10-year-old business, right? That was when they had real scale, right? Tinder was multiple stages earlier. But again, I'm not saying that's what you do to roll out from day one. But if you're a business, like if you can build your product offering to organically be seeded in as many markets as possible, that's helpful for you. And then you can be very focused and targeted from a messaging and a marketing perspective to say, where are the markets and where are the audiences that make you go, we can accelerate growth. This is where we place our bets, right? From a product perspective, you want scale quickly, got to run infinite tests, because the only downside is server space and engineering cost, right? But on a messaging and a marketing perspective, it's few. You want to be fewer, bigger, better to show that you can, by placing your bets in fewer places, you can accelerate those largest markets or those largest audiences.
Yeah. I think more
fewer, bigger, better. I've never heard that before.
The only caveat I would add is that playbook, it's so appropriate for product software-based businesses. When you're a service-based business, it's very like ill-wise to try and test something out across all your markets immediately, because you don't know at your stage whether that's going to work. And the logistical implications, there's a lot more at stake than sort of the code involved in rolling something out. So that would be my only caveat in addition to what Derek said, but 100% agreeing with the overall thoughtfulness of what you said, Derek.
I also think that when you're at a very early stage, which I've done a couple of times now, it's almost the inverse when you're thinking about product investment being passed, because if you try to divorce them, you'll end up getting false negatives in both directions, right? The product will look like it's not gaining adoption, but the reality is you're not focusing on the right hierarchy of features. Or the marketing will look like it's not converting, but it's because, you know, the product itself isn't the right fit for the market you've gone to. So like in that first like 0 to 5,000 customers, I would say, you almost can't think of message and product as two different things. You kind of have to be in one world where you're adjusting both together till you get to a point where you have enough confidence that you have a baseline in each world to then like iterate on separately.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's really about the stage of where your business is at. I mean, when everybody was at zero and we were running tests with our stealth concept, which had a totally different brand name that we rushed up to get sort of water through the pipes, we kept the funnel really wide because we didn't know. And as soon as we got a little bit of a trickle of a customer base, we were able to do some informal interviews with the folks who came in. And from there, we developed more specific hypothesis around what was going to work and crafting the content, the message, the value proposition. And we consistently iterate with our customers over time so that now we're very hyper-focused in our target audience, but it took a while to get there. So I would say for anyone on the call who is an earlier stage company and feeling kind of lost, like it is a process of culling it down and refining it to the point where you are really like functioning at a high level and you know what you're doing.
Is where it ended up pretty different than the original hypothesis you had of like day negative zero when you're sort of planning it out?
Absolutely. I mean, there were some things we thought would definitely work that tanked. And I think that's inevitable. It's part of the process. Obviously, it's, you know, test small, learn big, and like fail fast and cheaply. So it's about iterating, keeping an eye on the ads, and just a laser focus on everything that's going on so that spend isn't getting away from you without learning from it.
Okay, that's awesome. And what is a good way to like fail fast early on within when you're testing a message, brand, idea, or product? Like, how did you know some of your early hypothesis wouldn't have legs? Was it customer feedback? Was it just putting it in front of people asking if they buy? Was it running tests and seeing conversion rates? Like,
I mean, honestly, conversion rates was our best metric to begin with. But then once we actually had some customers, we were able to actually ask people. And I think asking people, I always try to stay as close to the customer as possible, because they will tell you what's working for them and why they came in and why they liked or didn't like the experience.
Makes a lot of sense.
Most of what I worked on lately has been software products and brands, although some have a service level element. And I think it's almost ironic because you feel this like religious fervor from like the product and dev side that continuous deployment, et cetera, but getting to a deployment that's actually ready to put in front of a user is a different thing from a deployment of a piece of code. So a lot of what I do is evangelize the idea that I'm not going to force you to have quarterly releases as long as every other one of those deployments is something I could actually put in front of an end user so that we can get feedback frequently and often. Because I, at an alpha stage, even having 15 folks that are truly going to be the end user playing with a half-baked piece of software, you settle so many internal debates that help you prioritize and focus. So that's been something I've pushed a lot.
Yeah, I love that. I think a lot of the founders we work with are a little too focused on the initial idea that they've come up with. Right. And scaling it and putting a bunch of dollars behind it when they haven't taken the time to focus on whether anyone actually cares about that product that they were initially putting out. And so I even think even when you're spending your first dollars, the goal shouldn't be figuring out what is going to drive revenue. It's figuring out what's going to drive accelerated learnings and focus on revenue or core goals or whatever's going to hit your like revenue or building out like revenue forecasts like down the road. But I found that a lot of early stage companies run themselves like later stage companies with like very specific targets when they could have done a little bit more work upfront to figure out whether what they were building was even valuable for whoever they're building it for. So that's a really great point. And Kay, what was sort of like the aha at some, was it just conversion rate or like what was the aha that you're like, all right, this is where we're going to end up and what's really working for people that we're talking to?
I don't think there was any one specific aha. We would put out a few different sets of creative and test a broad audiences. And where we found certain things getting traction, we would try to figure out what was going on with that particular ad. And just very granular. And it's very, you know, it's kind of a painstaking process of looking at each and everything and kind of developing a sense of why people are clicking on it. It could be a lot of different things. Sometimes it's color saturation, the creative, like the actual copy that's in it. It's something that there's so many variables that you're never going to be entirely sure where something works. But once you find something that's cranking, you can definitely get more insight into that from talking to your customers.
And did you ever use those insights to just change the fundamental complete direction of the company? Or was it more so you kind of had an idea of the product you wanted to sell? And this was more so changing kind of the messaging and how you packaged it and how you spoke and communicated with your customers?
I will say there were aspects of our service model that changed over time when we saw that we were getting more interest in certain types of ads that we put out. And a lot of that was around convenience or time in and out of the store, things like that. It just sort of changed the way we moved people through our locations. But, you know, we're a very young company and that was something we were not surprised. That was a process we went through because, as you said, you can't just like put something out there and expect it to be perfect. The product is evolving at the same time.
Makes a lot of sense. Thanks for that. How important is content kind of as an extension or expression of your brand, voice, brand behavior? And how have you kind of used content to be able to kind of spread your brand and your voice and kind of be uniquely the brand that you built out?
I could jump in here quickly. I think one of the interesting things when you're marketing leader, you always get asked, are you a brand marketer or are you a performance marketer? And my response is, I was always like, I don't really know. I've never had the luxury of being able to choose, right? I think the backbone of great content and great brand building is actually product marketing. And I think it's a skill set that is kind of lost a little bit as we sort of tend to go down to the first core objective you have. And a marketing function often is like this performance marketing team. And I think brands are expressions of customer experiences. And so I think if you apply that theory, then you're trying to really build the brand. It's not just about content. It's about all those little militant things from how your customer support responds to how you get to your standardized email, to your electronic invoices when you've purchased a product, how much fun can you have in those things? Like, so if you apply that, then I think what I've always tried to do is really use every opportunity to explain the benefits of your product. And so content is really putting the right context around how people use your product. And I find that if you're using all of this, and that's where sort of like brand work that's off to the side that doesn't showcase product, that sort of drives awareness without education is always a bit of a fail. So I think really find great content that just contextualizes how people use your product, that puts the right emotion around it, that makes your product relevant to different types of audiences, it is extremely powerful. But I think it's got to be really anchored in communicating the benefits of the product in a way that's engaging to different audiences. And I think that really shows up. Brand, if you sort of have the ethos that you want the brand or your personality of the business to show up in every touch point, I think content's a critical piece of that.
Obviously, you can create content for ads. You can create content for your specific products. If you're selling a physical good, there's even content in the packaging, the inserts, all of that. Where have you found that, and this is for anyone, where have you found that investing a lot of time and effort and iteration into a certain touch point ended up being really important for you? And yeah, which might like lead to advice for some people in the audience, like, okay, put some time into this area of content because it's incredibly important.
I've done a lot of work in fintech, especially over the last 5 years. So one, I totally agree with Derek. Like, I always talk to my teams about content being utility, and the lens through which we judge great content is the true value it provides, whether it's through efficiency or through deeper engagement with the product, not through entertainment. Like, the brand lens to me comes in tone. So it's utility first, and brand is the lens through which you evaluate how it sounds, not how you decide what to produce. But I think where I've seen the most value, both for brand and just for business performance, sounds like the most boring area of content, but I think it's actually really fascinating, especially if you think of it as a brand asset, which is help and self-service content. So, you know,
love that.
Especially spending a year working in a mortgage, where I think of myself as a relatively intelligent person. I've bought 2 homes. I work in digital transformation. Like, when I bought my second home, the process was incredibly difficult. And now working in lending in the small business space, like, these systems are just not user-friendly. So, like, the most pain a brand can relieve actually in a lot of these transactions and all of these financial universes is helping you understand the next smart step or helping you understand how to get your job done, and providing that content in a way that's simple and frictionless to access and does have a brand tone present, but in a way that's elegantly immersed into the content, not trying to prove the brand's voice, I think is really powerful. And from a business performance standpoint, the conversion it can impact, especially when you're looking at the CAC for like a financial services and lending brand, is massive.
I think the only piece I would add to this is vehemently agreeing with what you're saying. I do believe everything is content and everything communicates. So whether your interactions are online or offline, you're still communicating your brand ethos, your product value proposition, whatever the intent of that piece of content is. But I think what I've also found is consistency is extremely important, and clarity. What I mean by consistency is, yes, you're not going to use the same witty tone of voice in your views and your certain amounts of certain types of content, but you do want to make sure there's some consistency and a golden thread that's tying it together where it's not completely flavorless or completely off tone. To me, this idea of golden thread has become, through my career, even more important now, where I made a pretty significant investment earlier last year in redeveloping our brand, because you do need incredible brand assets if you're going to be communicating 24/7, which we all do now. And there is a value that you can put upon the salience that consistency of your brand assets can drive. Over time, I know that certain aspects of my brand, when someone sees them, whether they're in the form of an FAQ or testimonial, an ad, it's easily recognizable as, oh, this might be a feather piece of content. I think that content as an extension and expression of the brand voice and behavior is extremely important, but consistency and clarity of it is even more important.
That's great. I was always curious. I always hear how important it is to have a brand voice and a brand be consistent and fleshed out and like have your brand guide. But there's always been a disconnect between like what happens if you don't, what is the big issue, like where are things going to fall apart? So love to learn more. Like, okay, if you don't invest in having a consistent voice across all of your touch points, what kind of happens? Is the customer get confused, or?
You rarely see the impact immediately. I think brand voice and these elements are a long-term investment in brand. I liken it to farming and hunting, right? Like, investing in your brand, you're sowing the seeds so you can reap from them in the long term. The biggest thing I think investing in these pieces avoids is making your brand a commodity. With so many fintech apps out there, with so many dating apps out there, why is it that someone chooses Bumble versus Tinder? Why would someone choose my brand, Feather, versus one of the other rental brands out there when your service offering is pretty similar, right? Like, yeah, sure, some interaction may be different, or maybe pricing can be moderately different, but ultimately it's about why will someone pick my brand over someone else's? I think that's where you start seeing the investment you put in your tone of voice, your assets, how you show up in the world. That's where I believe it starts paying off.
I think that's an amazing answer.
I agree. I think the additional point, I think one of the biggest downsides when you don't have an agreement on sort of brand voice is inconsistency. And ultimately it ends up, particularly when you're early stage, like everyone is always, we're always testing. I think we're in whatever phase we're at, we're always testing. And I think you create massive inefficiency and inconsistency. And so you're wasting your tests. I think marketing is all about repetition, different flavors of ice cream, but always ice cream. And because I think when you're trying to create a whole new category, like Janelle's looking at, right, is like, you've got to chip away. Like, I think when you've got a big goal, like sometimes incrementality and being incremental is viewed as a dirty word, but like you build brands with consistent iterations and incremental improvements to a goal. If you don't have a goal for a business and you don't have a voice that you're trying to build to from a brand perspective, like you don't know what you're heading to. I think sometimes the thing that's always really interesting that I look at with like my last number of roles, I've been reporting directly to CEOs. And if you ever make the transition from like reporting to a C-suite or reporting to an SVP to a CEO, be careful what you wish for. You get it unfiltered. But the thing I love about the founders that I've worked for and worked with is that they index on two things: massive long-term vision, and they also know what to do on Monday. Like, it's very easy to build out a two-year plan or an annual plan. But I think those two things are really important. And that's where the brand voice, like consistency of like, it's going to help us with the little things. It's going to help us with the big things. And I think that if you get it wrong, it feels like busy work. If you get it right, it actually guides tactical things. It guides product marketing. It guides which influencers we want to go and work with. And most importantly, who we say no to. I think that's a really good test of all those things is like, is it busy work that's just going to get done once, be shiny and then get dusty on the shelf, or is it actually going to help us inform what we do on a daily basis?
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, I'm learning about consistency now. How do you even think about kind of explaining internally how to measure the ROI, brand building, and also any stories of the, I think anyone who's probably led brand and organization has probably had difficulty explaining it. So if there are any like kind of non-specific anecdotes of how those conversations have went, to sort of teach other people of what can go right and wrong and trying to explain that.
This is a big, hairy one. There's so many ways to answer this one. I think the one thing I'll say is ROI on brand building is not a month-over-month metric that you can track. I mean, I'm at a four-year-old startup right now. I'm not even going to measure my impact of all the brand work. Well, we'll talk about what is considered brand work well until like 2 years into what I'm doing. So right now, I'm really sort of focusing in on keeping my head down and doing the work. But I will say this, the outcome that I look for with brand building work is one, influence. Is my brand influencing conversations and conversions? And two, reputation. Is my brand respected, well thought of? Do people sort of think fondly of it when it's mentioned? And these things are hard to measure. Yes, you have your NPS scores and you can measure signals, right? I look at things like increase in unpaid conversion. I'll look at increase in inbound press requests, increase in growth rate. I think employee retention is a really good one to look at too. But I think the thing that I want to challenge with this notion of ROI on brand building is it's a business metric. It's not a marketing metric. This is a responsibility of the business and the C-suite and not just whoever's leading growth or whoever's leading marketing on your teams. And the reason for that is your brand is so much more than my communications, right? It's my digital product. In my case, it's my service aspect. So I have incredible delivery employees who actually enter people's homes and assemble the furniture. And what does that experience look like with them? It is the company culture. And what are the touch points that my head of people is reinforcing and choosing to reinforce? If there is a disconnect between who I am as a brand and what I show up in the world as, and what I show up internally as to my employees, that catches up with you pretty quickly, especially right now, and especially after 2020, the year we've had. So I will say, if there's one thing I try when someone asks me this question, I make sure they take away is make brand building a business metric. not just like a marketing metric. And it's important, the onus unfortunately lies with marketers for us to help educate the organizations, have these conversations with the C-suite, ensure that we are bringing them along on the journey and helping them understand the value of the long-term investment of this.
That was great. Yeah. You may not see the signals immediately. It's not like pushing an ad and seeing a dollar come out and seeing a $1.50 come in, right? So there is some level of faith that what you're doing pays off in the long run. Is that part of kind of what your answer was as well?
There's faith, but there's also enough data out there, right? Like there's a reason why Nike and Coca-Cola and, you know, these brands are what they are. So that it's proven. I think that is a fallacy that brand building is unproven. It just takes time, and you can never point to the one thing that built this brand. Maybe you can, but you usually can't. So I think it's, yes, as marketers, our instinct come into play, and we have to, I call it sort of informed intuition. But it really is about patience. I think, like, how do I measure the ROI on brand building? I'll just say with a lot of patience. That's my answer.
Nice. Okay. Any other thoughts from anyone else?
This is always a sensitive one for any VC-backed business because, generally speaking, there's a lot of focus on business growth and very hardcore metrics. So a conversation about investing in creatives, not necessarily where a lot of investors want to spend their time. And so I think a lot of founders, chief marketing officers are really doubly focused now, especially in 2021, on showing metrics that can accrete to brand building efforts. And I think a lot of what I'm hearing from the VC community now is, and especially in consumer products companies, is a focus on organic growth. And to me, that is really a measure of how well your brand is doing, how well your customers are evangelizing your brand, interacting with you online. Engagement is so important. And I think it's important to show your company's performance in those areas versus others to point to the fact that these expensive shoots or whatever influencer investments you're pouring money into are actually working. There really isn't a grace period anymore for something that's unmeasurable. There's not a tolerance for it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think a good example is Ward's push for and is really to sort of understand how quickly you can form the connection between a brand metric and a business metric. And to Kate's point, what I think exists and is really where I spend a lot of my time is how can you show that you can quantitatively impact above baseline organic growth? And that to me is powerful that in an oversimplified way, one of the narratives, I think if like Uber Eats is a good example of this, right? Their single most important brand metric is what sort of CPG companies call CP1, consumer preference one in a category. And they were really militantly focused on getting to that point. And I think if you get to that point, the metric that we sort of translated a version of this at Bumble is like, what does unaided awareness get you? What does an increase in unaided awareness get you with all other things being equal? And we ran some pretty good structured tests in the UK. Like it's a developed market enough, but when you actually begin to put consistent brand work into the market and you can track shifts in unaided awareness, then you start to sort of see, we could see quantitative impact on sort of increased organic growth. And to draw the analogy of Tinder and Bumble, the thing that's, that drives Tinder's, all other things being equal, they've got a great product, great growth loops. Their unaided awareness is over 90%. So like name a dating app, people say Tinder, right? And if you read Bumble's S1 letter, it's the most brand focused S1 letter I think I've seen in recent times because they know how important their brand investment is and how correlated it will be to. But I think that unaided awareness and tying that to above how long it takes for the water to flow through the pipes, to Kate's point on impacting organic growth, is really where you can get private equity and VC orientated boards to be like, okay, I understand the payback here. And what that does is it also doesn't put what I think has become an unhealthy reliance. If businesses don't understand the importance of brand, they then go to this unhealthy reliance on performance marketing, which reduces the accountability that you want to put on the whole company to drive a great product with all those great referral loops and everything that when combined with a great brand, drives up that organic growth.
Makes a lot of sense. And Kate, to what you're mentioning of the that kind of window shrinking between, or maybe not even existing these days, in terms of like putting efforts into brand and then seeing some kind of very specific payback, it is kind of organic search or an organic kind of traffic to your site the main metric that you might use to show that those efforts are or maybe are not paying off?
Yes. I mean, we always want to show organic increasing as a percentage of our total customer acquisition. I mean, that's just one of the things that we focus on month after month. And I think it is a really great measure of the health of a brand. And I'm not saying don't invest in brand. I think I'm one of the biggest advocates of great content, spending time on brand values, really sorting out your point of difference and how you're solving problems for people. I'm far from like everything has to be quantitative. I just think there are ways you can measure brand building efforts. And I think the discipline of marketing is evolving to come up with those metrics. And that's kind of each of our jobs in marketing is to find a way to show that it's working.
Awesome. Thanks for that. Are there any things that you've done in your career where you look back on it and now think, okay, maybe if I knew a few more things and if I knew what I knew now, I would have done it a little bit differently? And any sort of anecdotes to help some people avoid some of those hurdles or missteps? Or that you basically just have to make missteps because that's the only way you're going to learn anything?
I'll give an example that I'm kind of in the middle of learning right now, which is, I think because my experience came up more in digital transformation and kind of like holistic customer experience architecture than traditional marketing first path to a marketing seat, I could be pretty dismissive of things that lived more on the brand side that I kind of thought of as frivolous. Things like influencer marketing, where it seemed more like, oh, this is a bunch of silly Instagram stories versus this isn't like the hardcore value prop that drives ROI. So I think questioning your own arrogance in terms of the nucleus of where you started and examining the power of some of the tools that may or may not be at the center of your wheelhouse is important. I've just, as I'm starting to build a brand right now, that's an alpha with the smallest budget I didn't even know budgets this small existed when I was working in consulting. The power of some of those tactics that I previously thought of as more frivolous to get through the first stage of the growth that I've committed to my investors is humbling and super interesting.
That's awesome. I like the humbling aspect there.
I think one thing for me that I saw a couple of times is we're trying to shift the brand or get it or shift the perception from one to another. And I'll sort of give an example at Tinder was I think you're always thinking that you can shift perception faster than actually happens. It goes back to that repetition point I had before. I think you're impatient. And I think one of the most important things that I look for in my team is judgment. And I'll give an example. When I first joined Tinder, on any given day, one of the top three download markets in the world is the US, India, and Brazil. And when I was there, it was always those were the top new download markets. And that sort of shows the breadth of the product, but also that you've got some really different markets there. And obviously, one of the things that Tinder had a challenge with was sort of that it was viewed as a bit of a hookup app, right? I think the brand has found its voice really, the company's found its voice really consistently now, and I think that's a good thing. The team launched a piece of content on my second week there, and looking back, I should have not let it go live, but it was a small piece of content that showed an Indian woman getting ready for a date. Talking to her mother and her mother's helping her sort of get dressed and get ready. And she's very nondescript about where she's going. And then you hear the Tinder sounds of the notifications going off on her phone. And at the end of it, she sort of says she's going on a Tinder date. And the mother said, I already knew. And it was interesting because when it went out, YouTube comments a deep, dark hole, but you learn a lot if you have a thick skin. And instantly it was like, it was so clear that this content was reaching. It was attempting to change a perception that was going to take multiple years to do. And the question was whether we even really needed to do it. And there were a whole bunch of things. It was such an oversimplified approach. And I think it just was a great learning on being patient and being consistent when you're wanting to get your voice out. A single piece of content, a single campaign will not do it. One of the other panels talked about these iconic brands that are institutions that have been around for multiple generations and they still have a consistent voice, but they evolve. It's like that takes time. And I think one of the real challenges for having worked in after my time at Google, being in sort of slightly earlier stage businesses is everyone wants quick returns. and everyone wants quick shifts, but you've got to, on some parts of your business, you've got to adapt really quickly. But on the things that are important, you've got to be consistent over time. And I think sometimes that's hard. Like, I'm inherently an outcome-orientated person, and I find myself being impatient. And that's been a big learning. I think in some of these situations, I wish I'd been a bit more patient and a bit more consistent and sort of held the line a bit longer.
I'll share a little bit about the Everbody brand building journey. I was so excited to launch this brand around a product that I had felt really needed to exist, and hired a great branding firm that we loved working with and was going to try to establish this amazing luxury brand, prestige brand at the intersection of healthcare and beauty. Super exciting. And choosing the logo, the fonts, the colors was all-encompassing project at a time when we needed to be moving very fast. And I think one of the things I learned from that time was you're not going to create your point of difference or your true brand recognition based on pixels. You can belabor your first homepage to the nth degree, and it won't be a great use of your time at the end of the day, because a lot of people can copy that. And I think we've all seen the convergence of brand identities, kind of like the blending of brands, I think is a term I've seen thrown around. You're going to create your point of difference around your brand values, how you speak to customers, your ethos, your service model, et cetera. There's so many things that ladder up to that. And I actually felt like, oh gosh, we've created this amazing space. Everything in the market is pink and sparkly, and nobody wants pink and sparkly, so we'll do green. And I actually was quoted in the Wall Street Journal saying, nobody wants pink and sparkly. And like 2 months later, our biggest competitor changed their entire color palette to green. So that was a big learning for me personally, that you've got to do a little bit more than what's on the screen.
I love that. And I think the most staunchest advocates for how important brand is would probably say your brand is just not your font and your model and your sort of cool one-liner that gets put on the L train. It's a little bit more 360 than that.
I think, yes, I do think though there is a lot of value, and Kate, I'm sure your green is going to show dividends over time. I think for me, this is my first experience working at such an early stage company. And I think there are a couple of things that I feel like I have to unlearn in this environment. One is, I think at bigger companies, because sort of you establish that product market fit, and like Swell, at Swell, we barely spent anything on marketing. Everything was inbound. People just wanted the product. I feel like, I call it like you catch fire, and then you really don't need, if it's a great product in the right moment at the right time, marketing's job is much easier in that moment. Here, we are building a new behavior. We are trying to challenge some existing perceptions. I think the one thing I've realized is I will never have enough data that I'm going to need. And even the data I have, it doesn't really always paint a true picture. The more I poke holes into it, the more it becomes hard to trust any decision that data would prescribe. I think the one thing I find myself saying a lot to my team and myself is have conviction. I have to keep reminding myself of that as well, too. But I think having conviction in, to a certain extent, we are told as marketers to not always trust our own judgment, because yes, you might be the customer, but you're not like really speak to the customers, and we do that. But at some point, we also can't forget that this service, it was created to solve a very specific need a lot of us as customers are also feeling. And I try and make sure that I don't completely dismiss my own intuitive voice and my own voice of reason, and that of my teams as well. I think that has been slightly hard for me to get to this point, but I'm always now asking my team, instead of like, give me a business case and show me the data. Yes, they do all of that, but I'm also ending with like, well, what do you think? And what is your point of view? It's jarring for my team members sometimes. It's not necessarily a vocabulary or a muscle memory they're used to exerting, but I think it's really important because we don't have all the right answers right now. And I can tell you, even with my attribution, I can see a direct correlation between my organic numbers and my paid numbers. So the months where I'm spending more money, my organic is higher. So what does that tell you, right? It's like, I can't just rely on all the data that I have right now. So I think that to me, over the course of last year, has been a pretty big learning and unlearning.
That's really great. Who helps you make critical decisions, and what do you value about them? Could be folks that you've brought along with you throughout your entire career, mentors, old team members, current team members, current CEOs, anything like that. But would love to know kind of who's been by your side to help you out with some of these very difficult decisions?
I'll go quickly. It's a cheesy answer, but I think it's like the customer and the non-customer. Like, I think insight here is really important. I think, like, if you're in a data-rich business, I think there's some of my early conversations and seeing how Google made decisions early on. Like, I think when you've got massive amounts of data, two things made really good decisions, drove decisions. And the first board meeting I sat in with Eric, Larry, and Sergey on presenting something was related to, I forget the product actually, but it was actually with Google Maps. And when you've got really massive amounts of data that Google had, the other end of the spectrum was like a really passionate email or a conversation with one user, right? And I think piecing those two things together is really important. I think that the type of research that I'd see high data-rich companies really reject was like statistically significant sample-based quantitative research that went out to the market with a third-party research company, right? So what I found is like qualitative insight from customers and just any opportunity to talk to people, early stage businesses at FAIR was really interesting. It was like one of our offerings was to ride share customers. So like I spent 2 full days just riding Uber everywhere, talking to drivers about, did they own their car? Did they not own their car? How do they think about accessing? Were they driving using a lease, which was a bad thing? Like just listening is really powerful, and it's not statistically significant. It's not going to show up on a spreadsheet, but customer insight for me is huge. And then the only other person internally I find, if you're in a technology business, talking to engineers, fascinating. Really fascinating. They think they're also consumers, but they're very data driven and they think in really abstract and really interesting ways, particularly if you're so connecting marketing folks to engineers. I'd make my team do lunches. You really learn. You learn about the product, you learn about the guys that are building it, and you learn about really quantitatively driven consumers.
I love that. That's great. I can speak a little bit to this. I think one of the mistakes I made earlier in my career was not seeking out peers to learn from people who were doing similar roles as me at other organizations, learning how they kind of go about it, learning how they work their way politically and all of that. I think there was a lot of learnings I could have had to level up. And that's something I've tried to correct quite a bit in the last few years and like actively reaching out to people who are at a similar level and doing very similar things to me so I can learn at that exact moment. I've played a few different roles in my career. So these days I'm actively reaching out to people who have run agencies and have run services-based organizations to understand how do they structure it? How do they think about it? If I move on to do something else later on or whatever else, I'd find people who are doing the exact same thing, whether it's building a product, whether it's anything else. And I think those functions evolve. I think the way you run an agency in 2021 is kind of different than you may have run it in 2011. So finding someone right now who's going through the same problems I'm going through has been really valuable. And I wish I definitely did that a lot earlier in my career.
Yeah, I think that with making critical decisions for business, I value objectivity a lot. I think especially if they have decisions about the team or what area to focus on, not necessarily to do with marketing per se, I always seek out my peers. Sometimes I agree with what they say, sometimes I disagree, but they always give a very unvarnished, unattached point of view. And that is very valuable. And I make sure that if I'm considering a critical decision, I try and speak with the teams who that will impact. I think it's important for me to hear from the teams on how positively or negatively a decision might impact them or their perception of the impact it will have on them. Oftentimes it comes from a place of passion and conviction. Like I said, I appreciate that, but it's important to take those two data points, the unattached, unvarnished, and the passion-filled one, and use those to make that decision.
Love all these answers. And I totally agree with customer first, then your peers, because everything is evolving so quickly in marketing. There's always something that somebody else learned before me. And it's a learning that would be really valuable to my business. As our company's grown in size, our board has also grown. And I really valued our board members' insight because so many of them are investors who are seeing comparable businesses grow and they're able to share some of those like little points of lightning in a bottle that might be relevant for us. And just seeing the market from 30,000 feet can sometimes be really powerful if you're so in the weeds in your own space.
Thanks for tuning in to Culture, Talent, and Growth. If you found value in this conversation, please leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with a friend. You can visit bringruckus.com for more ways to connect. And remember, new episodes come out on Tuesday.